One of the most enduring images of revolutionary turmoil in music dates from the spring of 1809. Vienna found itself under siege from Napoleon's troops. Many Austrian citizens had decided to up sticks and flee the capital for their own safety. But Beethoven was one of those who decided to stay and try to carry on working as normal, although that was far from easy. The story goes that he spent most of the time hiding in the cellar with pillows over his ears, trying to protect his fragile hearing from the sound of cannon fire. "We have passed through a great deal of misery," Beethoven wrote at the time. "The whole course of events has affected me body and soul, nor can I have the enjoyment of country life so indispensable to me. Nothing but drums, cannons, men, misery of all sorts." Well, out of those terrible circumstances came the great piano concerto, The Emperor, a nickname that was invented, it seems, by, in fact, a close friend of Beethoven's, the composer Johann Baptist Cramer. Beethoven himself being someone who didn't have that much time for emperors, a subject I'll be turning to later. Just as the political map of Europe was being redrawn, so too was its artistic landscape. Like all of the creative arts, music was undergoing a profound revolution in the way it was being conceived, performed, and enjoyed. Even the lifestyles of early 19th century composers were quite different from those of their counterparts a century before. In the mid-18th century, the working relationship for a musician was quite simple. Generally speaking, if you were a musician, you needed an employer. This could either be a municipal council, such as the one that employed Bach in Leipzig or Telemann in Hamburg. It could be a church or cathedral. Or it could be a court. And the richer the establishment, the more scope you had for creative endeavour. A ruler with particularly deep pockets was Augustus the Strong. The Kapellmeister at his Dresden court was Johann Adolf Hasse, who was married to the opera diva Faustina Bordoni. And they were a couple with considerable earning power. Together they earned 16 times what Bach did in Leipzig. With a sympathetic employer, like Haydn's at the court of Esterhazy, for example, a composer could spend many happy and creative years in service. Living in the pocket of an unsympathetic employer, though, was no easy matter. Take the difficult relationship that Mozart had with Archbishop Colloredo in Salzburg, for example. As part of the official retinue, Mozart accompanied the Archbishop when he travelled to Vienna in 1781. By this time, Mozart was a rising star, a favourite with royalty and nobility all over Europe. But he felt that his employers weren't giving him the recognition he deserved. Having to sit at table below the valets summed up his position in the courtly pecking order all too well. And after a stormy meeting with the Archbishop, Mozart found himself booted out of his job quite literally with a sharp kick on the backside from one of the court's flunkies. So Mozart found himself free to go and establish his reputation in Vienna. And if he was taking a bit of a risk in doing so, it's one that certainly paid off. 5 years later, Mozart had become the city's A-list composer. Whether it was with operas, string quartets, orchestral music or piano concertos, Mozart had the Viennese Conoscenti right in the palm of his hand. Thank you. And 5 years after that, the young Beethoven arrived in Vienna to try his fortune in the early 1790s, and a dynamic musical culture was there to greet him. Vienna was a thriving capital in the years leading up to the Napoleonic Wars. Aristocrats from all over the Austrian and German states spent several months a year in the capital, and if they had resident composers in their service, then, naturally enough, they came along too. That's how it worked for Mozart in the reluctant employ of the Archbishop of Salzburg, as I said, and Haydn more happily with the Esterházy family. Beethoven, though, was in the service of nobody. He set out to go it alone as a freelance musician. All the same, he did know which side his bread was buttered on. Emperor Francis's brother, Archduke Rudolf, was one of his pupils. And unlike Mozart, Beethoven dedicated almost all of his works to aristocrats, including the Russian ambassador, Prince Razumovsky. But crucially, Beethoven was free from them. By this time, music for Beethoven was not merely a craft to be exercised for the pleasure or the moral edification of others, as it had been in Bach's day. Music was a form of artistic endeavour, a powerful tool for self-exploration, and indeed something that itself brought Beethoven back from the brink. In the autumn of 1802, he travelled to a little country town outside Vienna called Heiligenstadt and wrote the most pitiful letter to his brother. This was the so-called Heiligenstadt Testament, breaking the news that he'd gone almost completely deaf. Years later, he recalled, "I could have ended my life there. I was only held back by my art." From that desperate point, it's only 1 year to the creation of the great Third Symphony, a work that's revolutionary in so many ways. It's constructed on an enormous scale, the like of which had never been seen in a symphony before. Its opening movement is based not on a main theme, but a group of little motives. Who better to dedicate this revolutionary work to than Napoleon Bonaparte, who Beethoven initially saw as the liberator of Europe and a leader who had come from the people. But later, when Bonaparte crowned himself emperor, Beethoven literally scratched out the dedication to Napoleon and renamed the symphony Eroica, composta per festeggiare il souvenir d'un grand uomo, composed to celebrate the memory of a great man. And if Beethoven was disillusioned with Napoleon, well, it wasn't for the first or the last time that a powerful political leader turns out not to be all he's cracked up to be. If Napoleon had a profound influence on composers all over Europe, what about the position in France itself? For an example of the glories of music in pre-revolutionary days, you need look no further than the leading concert society in Paris, Le Concert de la Loge Olympique. It was led by the dashing Chevalier de Saint-Georges, a brilliant Afro-French musician who was just as handy with his fencing épée as his violin bow. And the orchestra was the biggest and most brilliant in France at the time, with outfits to match. For concerts, its players wore sky blue tailcoats with swords as an ornamental extra. This is the orchestra that Haydn wrote a set of six Paris symphonies for, including this one in G minor. How much was he thinking of his French forces when he created these dazzling moments of rich orchestral sound? One of the foreign composers who decided to move to Paris for good was Luigi Cherubini, although he picked a pretty eventful time to do it. He arrived there just in time to make friends with the Ancien Régime. 8 years and one revolution later, he found himself conducting a band at a concert celebrating the anniversary of Louis XVI having his head chopped off. And he wasn't alone. Gossec was another foreign composer, Belgian this time, who established himself in France before having to do some fancy footwork to keep in with his new political masters. This was much more than a question of just changing the name of the ruler. For the new setup, a whole new sound was called for. The glories of the French Revolution were celebrated in fêtes by ensembles comprising hundreds of singers and players, with wind instruments a speciality. The more and the raspier wind instruments, the better. And it was in France in 1803, that year that Beethoven wrote his Eroica Symphony, that Hector Berlioz was born. A child of the French Revolution, if ever there was one, and someone who encapsulated everything that Romanticism seemed to be about. Impulse, emotion, and a passion as strong for theatre and literature as it was for women. It was his simmering emotion for the Irish Shakespearean actress Harriet Smithson that inspired his masterpiece, the Symphonie Fantastique of 1830. Another piece he wrote that year was a competition cantata. As he reached the end of it, the July Revolution broke out. And this is how Berlioz describes the experiences in his memoirs. I dashed off the final pages of my orchestral score to the sound of stray bullets coming over the roofs and pattering on the wall outside my window. On the 29th, I had finished and was free to go out and roam about Paris until morning, a pistol in my hand. Berlioz is probably the best example of someone whose inner turmoil found direct external expression in his music. And inspired by Beethoven's example, he tore up the rulebook of tradition like no other composer of the time. In the new Romantic era, there was no place for excessive reverence of the past, and this was something neatly summed up by Stendhal in his field as a writer. Romanticism, he said, is the art of presenting to people the literary works which can afford them the greatest pleasure. Classicism presents them with works which gave the greatest possible pleasure to their great-grandparents. For another man of letters, Giovanni Berchet, writing in 1816, classicism was the poetry of the dead and romanticism was the poetry of the living. By that time, of course, that great political revolutionary Napoleon was safely recaptured and cooling his heels on St. Helena. But both in the world of politics and in music, things would never be quite the same again.